Dublab. Welcome to The Quarantine Tapes, a daily podcast from Onassis, LA and Dublab. Hosted by Paul Holdengraber, this series chronicles shifting paradigms in the era of social distancing.
Hello?
Hello, could I please speak with Sacha Frere-Jones?
I'm right here.
Hello, Sacha. This is Paul Holdengraber, calling you from the Quarantine Tapes, which is co-presented by Onassis LA and Dublab. I'm so happy you could take the time to take my call. Thank you so very much. Tell me, Sacha, how have you been spending these last 13 or 14 months of this delirious time we're living through?
I don't think we've done anything remarkably different from anyone else. I think my partner, Heidi, and I, we get along really well. I get along with her kids. It hasn't all been bad. We flourished pretty much in the house together. We left the Christmas lights up. They were very cheerful, so we have lights on all the time. Very colorful lights. That helped.
This immediately makes me think of the incredible amount of time we spend both at home and we spend with our children or children of our partners. It's an extraordinary moment because in many ways, I think, many families have never spent so much time together. They always want to spend more time together, they say, and here we are.
That's an interesting point. I think it made our families draw closer together. I had a fairly large event in January. The mother of my children died, and she died of pancreatic cancer. It wasn't related to COVID, and I have been mostly away from my boys that entire time. But here's a direct response to what you're talking about. And this turned out to be a huge blessing is that Deborah and her now husband, Van, were staying in Connecticut, a house that Deborah's family had. And so from March onwards of 2020, they were together in quarantine and both of my sons were there with her. And my son Jonah's girlfriend was there with him too. And she got the diagnosis at the end of July. So they were together for 9 months unbroken. And having all of that time together is a massive blessing because many people I myself lost a parent very suddenly when I was 30, and I hadn't seen my dad in a while. He was in Massachusetts. So when you lose a parent, it's very common to think that you wish you had more time.
Right. You always wish for that last conversation you might have that would be meaningful. And you so often are not granted that because life is busy.
Absolutely. And I think Deborah was very, I know because she told me, she was very aware of having a good death. When she gave up on the chemo and just came home, you know, to do hospice, she was in this beautiful house in Connecticut where she married her, you know, I married her there in 1994 and then we got divorced and she married her childhood sweetheart, it turns out, in September for a bunch of different reasons. It was an amazing wedding and she was basically there for the last few months of her life with her children, with her partner, and she was really happy. She knew she was getting, especially right now, she was having a very incongruous experience having this death with so much intentionality and so much pleasure and you know she knew she had great medical care. She was extremely aware of how lucky she was to be having this kind of death, to have the opportunity to go the way she went. I don't think that she was upset beyond, you know, the fact of being upset because you're going to die sooner than you want to, but she seemed to understand. And then she had created that situation for herself. So anyway, that's maybe a little bit rambling, but in terms of spending time with family.
But I think, Sacha, you know, particularly I would say in these times, this conjures up all kinds of thoughts. And I'm wondering actually if it conjures up thoughts in you and a desire perhaps even to write about it.
When you say it, do you mean the pandemic?
No, I mean the death of Deborah.
Oh, well, I sort of did. She asked me to finish my memoir, which I had begun a while ago. I had begun it originally because she told me that she wanted me to write this. She'd always been very supportive of my writing. In fact, she's sort of responsible for a chunk of my career because in early 2002 or three, she said, "Stop bitching about these terrible people writing about pop music in New Yorker. You should just write David Remnick a letter." And I said, "He's not going to fucking read a letter that I write. Like, that's a crazy idea. And it was not a crazy idea. It was the perfect idea. And so, but she also asked me to write a memoir, and I began it a while ago, and it was very bad. But somewhere in August, September, you know, I barely saw her during the whole thing. You know, I saw her once at the wedding, and that was it. We didn't even talk that often. She was very, she really wanted to have her privacy and do this thing largely alone, which was hard for me. That's a different aspect of the pandemic. But
right.
She asked me to finish this memoir. I did. I got it printed. It was the last book she read. And I'm working on it now to put it out, you know, for the world, because it wasn't really written for the world, although some friends of mine like it. But, you know, they're my friends, so, you know, I don't know if I can trust them. So there will be more in it. For instance, I didn't put anything about Deborah dying in the version she was going to read. That didn't seem like something you'd want to read. So it'll be probably about twice as long. And it's, you know, it's about my life, so it's only partially about her, but I will put in the things I have to say about her, which are, you know, she was a profound part of my life. An interesting part of this process, and anyone who's grieved knows, they're all awful in different ways, but, you know, the sense of the absence, me thinking of her is essentially a daily, it's almost like a routine thing. When I go to sleep, I have usually a dream about her at first. Like, I have a sort of pre-dream. It's like a trailer before the movie. Like, I sort of check in with her. I mean, it's not always pleasant. It's usually actually not very pleasant, but it's how my brain and soul are processing the events. I mean, I think of her during the day too, but you know, this is somebody we, you know, stopped being a couple in 2006, but we stayed very close. We have children, and, you know, we liked each other. There was no, you know, there was no acrimony in our being apart from each other. And she got to go back to Ben, her high school sweetheart, which I think is actually quite nice. I sort of like that the story branched in that way. So I think most of what I have to say will be in the book, but it may take me a long time to actually come up with anything intelligent to say, because I don't know what I have to say, to be honest, but I should be done with this in a couple of months, I think.
You know, it's been interesting during this quarantine with these quarantine tapes, which are reaching nearly 200 episodes. It's been, of course, a recurring subject. The subject of loss, the subject of grief, whether it's speaking with someone like Ed Hirsch and speaking about heartbreak, or Terry Tempest Williams, or so many others, or actually a very short poem of Naomi Shihab Nye, which I want to read to you. It's 3 lines long.
That's short.
Very short. Very short.
Go for it.
People do not pass away. They die, and then they stay.
What was the last word?
I'll read it to you again. People do not People do not pass away. They die, and then they stay.
That's pretty great for 3 lines. That's 100% true in my experience. I have a couple of metaphors that I've been carrying around since my dad died. I was 30. My first son was about to be born in 1997, and he had a series of very quick heart attacks, and boom, he was gone. And a thing that I began to think in the following years is, when somebody dies, like especially in the immediate family unit, you don't know what part of the house they were holding up. You don't know if somebody was a lamp or were they the retaining wall. Like, you don't know how much they provided until you take them away. And in his case, he sort of was binding the immediate family unit. So, you know, with Deborah gone, and she was just a massive presence. And my poor boys, like, they also lost their grandmother 2 years ago in a car accident. So I don't think they should have had to deal with all this, but they're doing amazingly well. But, you know, as time goes on, we'll figure out what the Deborah shaped hole in the house is. You know, how much did she provide? I went back to the house in Connecticut for the first time. I was outside the house for the wedding, but I hadn't been inside it in 10 years. It used to be somewhere I lived. So just this weekend, I saw Sam, my older son, there. And in some ways, the mundane aspects of her were the nicest part. Like, we watched him watching soccer. He's an Arsenal fan. He bets on certain games. He's very, very, his grieving and sort of pandemic process has involved nonstop sports, mostly soccer. And we got to make salmon together. And, you know, I was in a house that had all these different meanings. But one of the things about grieving that's sort of an interesting part that isn't, like, you know, something obvious like sadness is, if you're paying attention to your surroundings, you're in the now. Like, it's now. It's 2021. It's not 1999. So I can have those memories, but the energy of the house is what it is now, and it's different. And that does help you get your mind around, okay, what is the shape of everything now? Not that we know, because we're in the very early stages of this, but yeah, that was sort of a big event over the weekend.
You know, I'm always reminded by a psychoanalyst friend of mine who, when I lost my sister, said to me, don't ever forget that Freud spoke about the work of mourning.
Mm. That's so great. My wife or fiance or my partner, Heidi, is a psychoanalyst. And so we talk a lot about Freud. She's mostly annoyed that people, as with Marx, they quote ideas of his and get them wrong all the time and they never read the original. So I think she wants everyone to read the standard edition. And then I know somebody else who thinks you shouldn't even read the standard edition in English. Anyway, I was reading Mourning and Melancholia the other day because she said, I bet you think you know this essay, which is true in my pretentious way. I was like, oh, I know that essay. And then she's like, yeah, but when did you last read it? Of course, A, I don't know when I last read it. And B, there's always a very good chance that I haven't even read it. So
right.
I was reading it and it was remarkable, as Freud always is. I mean, it's interesting that the way we think about the foundations of whatever. I mean, I don't want to pretend that universities are a thing I endorse or the idea of civilization, but we talk a lot about Freud and Marx, and it would be interesting to have a university course that was simply, without any other text, just reading Freud and Marx, reading all of them in the original as much as you could get through, and just having that and discussing what you found, but actually reading as much of the original as humanly possible. That would be, considering some of the arguments I see happening online, I think that wouldn't be such a bad idea. I would, of course, rather do it for free. But
Sasha, I read this morning an essay by Alex Ross, a little review, really, in the current issue or forthcoming issue of The New Yorker, called "The New York Philharmonic Mourns and Rebuilds." And
I haven't read it.
It's really excellent, and I want to read you a little passage and have you react to it maybe in the musical sphere you inhabit. I think,
sure.
You know, he talks about the Philharmonic, but my guess is that it applies in a much larger context. He says the composer Nico Muhly spoke for many colleagues this past March when he told the Times, "I don't think there is a return to normal in the performing arts, I'm sorry to say. We have to make a new normal and build a lot of it from scratch. This period has shone light on an unbelievable amount of baked inequality and rotten practices rooted in the foundation of everything we do." So that was Nico Muhly. And then Alex comments, "The setting was strange. 23 string players and one percussionist gathered at the Shed, the performance complex at Hudson Yards. An audience of 150 people were distributed in distant pods across the floor at the McCourt, the Shed's cavernous central space." And then he says, "On the podium was Esa-Pekka Salonen, the former leader of the Los Angeles Philharmonic and the new director of the San Francisco Symphony. And he says that Salonen remarked from the stage and said how this program was marked by a sense of longing, nostalgia, and loss. But he also conveyed," Alex says, "how much it meant for both him and the musician to see the audience face to face. Concertgoers felt likewise. Although outdoor performances and online events have supplied sustenance during the pandemic year, the act of listening in an enclosed room defines musical life, as Salonen observed. I had missed more acutely than I knew the materiality of sound, the feeling of being struck by a sonic wave." I'm wondering how that resonates for you.
It resonates in two ways. I'm thinking, I'm in a band now called Body Meta, and
yes,
we're named after the Ornette Coleman record, but our name is spelled with a funny pi symbol.
I know,
so it's a little bit confusing.
I saw that. I saw that. I was sort of scratching my head and saying, I studied Greek. Anyway, go ahead.
It actually makes some emails go into a spam filter, so we're already challenged. But
okay,
we made our first record right before the pandemic started back in February, and it's being issued by a label called Hausu Mountain on May 28th. which is great. And we're getting together in, I think, a week or two to start work on another record. And we have been talking about, I mean, we haven't even played that much together. We just happened to, we've known each other for a very long time. And it's been a beautiful, beautiful experience so far. And I'm nothing but thrilled about every aspect of it. And we were talking about where to play live, or if we would play live. And we record in the place where Greg lives in Gowanus. I used to live there too. It's a very, very big loft. And we thought, all right, well, maybe we'll just play in the loft and have people in, because there are so few venues left, and we don't even know where to go exactly. And the other thing is, but anyway, I'm very excited by the idea of all this happening. And the, I mean, there's sort of two situations in that piece you were reading from, is that what Nico said about all the things we can get rid of. That's another aspect we think of, and I'm writing a piece about this now, like, how do musicians, what is the job of being a musician? What does it really consist of? Right. How do we actually make money? It's not all about Spotify. I've heard more than enough about Spotify for three lifetimes. We make money in a whole bunch of different ways. And somebody like me, obviously, I don't make my money from music. And I made a decision when I was young to not do that, but that doesn't mean it's the way to do it. It's just a thing I decided. And it has, you know, has its ups and downs, or pros and cons, not ups and downs. But in terms of that being in the same space, I can come back to the things it would be good to destroy and the things we've left behind that we need to leave behind. In terms of that commonality in space, I went to I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went to a meeting on Sunday. And the first time I've been in person with anybody indoors in like a group setting, other than buying a coffee or something. And it was a meditation meeting, which is, you know, the 11th step. We meditate to improve our conscious contact with God. And it was a genuinely profound experience. And I'm going to tell you that it was my 2-year anniversary on Monday. I went because I wanted to.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. It was very, very shallow and selfish of me. I love the coins. The coins mean a lot to me. I like to have it to market. I'm a little OCD. The token just helps me tie myself physically to the act, and other people can bless the coin. It's the way I am. So I went there really, you know, I wanted to get a meeting in, but I also really just wanted the coin, which somebody there gave me, which was beautiful. But the experience of being in a room with other people was complete. I mean, it was blissful. It was wonderful. And it was also such a reminder of how time and space and attention works in person. Like, there was no part of me that wanted to be looking at a screen or checking my email. Like, we meditated for 20 minutes and then everyone shared. And it was completely nourishing in every possible sense. And I often am as annoyed by the program as I am by anything else, just the way, like, I love being in a band. And then, you know, by the 20th rehearsal, you want to kill each other. When you're in a van in Germany, you want to kill each other. Like, whatever. These things go up and down. But we all know that we want this experience, and I hope that everyone has an experience like this. But my heart really kind of, and I was having a bad couple of weeks, my heart really just leapt when I remembered that the magic of proximity and simultaneous experience is really, it's something else. And I think one of the good things about coming out of the pandemic, we hope, is, or I don't know if I should say out of it, whatever's coming next involves a lot of appreciating things in a new way. And also, as Nico was saying, you know, the things we have to leave behind. Yes. And all of the completely insane things like Spotify, or the ways that musicians are expected to live, that everyone's expected to live. I mean, Zoom calls, for whatever people like them or don't like them or their feelings, I think it's going to be very interesting to see in the coming years when somebody proposes a meeting. And this is something that maybe if you, you know, like me, a freelancer, you don't have a ton of time and money, but if somebody important wants to have a meeting in Midtown, well, you know, traditionally you would go, and it would be 3-4 hours out of your day. You're maybe having 10 minutes of actual conversation. That's a bunch of nonsense. We don't need to do that ever again. There's no reason for anyone ever to have a meeting like that ever again. We can hop on a Zoom, bang it out, go back to what we're doing. There's no reason to burn the planet up for these ridiculous meetings. If there's a reason to have the meetings at all.
Yeah, further burn it up.
Yeah, further burn it up. Yeah, the burning will continue. I mean, there are a lot of things that are going to be reconsidered. And, you know, the sort of, in speaking of burning it down, with everybody sort of, well, not everyone, but lots of people sort of zeroing out their income and getting down to, like, how am I going to live questions, going back to something like live music or music in any sense really does give you the option to say, okay, now that my counters have, without my consent, been reset, you know, now that I'm at this new kind of zero, there's no new normal, but there might be a new zero. What am I going to do from here? What am I going to not do from here? Am I really going to tour the country for a net total of $600 over 2 months? Like, I don't think I'm going to do that. And I'm going to look at different ways to put my art together and to work on it and not feel like I'm completely, you know, on the knife's edge, because we've been living on the knife's edge for 14 months. So I think this will hopefully, I mean, and there are things more important than, you know, people playing music that need to be reset. So I think it's all of a piece, and it could be extremely, I mean, it's been sort of volcanic. The last year has been unlike anything I've ever experienced. You know, I don't think the uprising of last summer would have happened without the pandemic there to kind of loosen up everybody's, you know, spiritual strength.
You know, just the sentence that follows where I stopped with Sullen, and where Alex says, I had missed more acutely than I knew the materiality of sound, the feeling of being struck by a sonic wave. He says, that sensation of collective surrender was in stark contrast to the illusion of solitary mastery that home listening creates. To be sure, technology was still mediating the experience in the wide open McCourt. The orchestra required amplification. But the heft of the sonorities was real enough that at climaxes I found myself bowing my head, a bit overwhelmed. And I'm wondering, Sasha, when this pandemic too passes and we go back for what passes for normal, what do you imagine music will look like? And by that I mean performances. And I might say, what will it look like, but what do you hope it will look like?
That's a good question. Of course, the honest, immediate answer is I don't know, but I'll answer that question by going back to Alex's comment. I've been listening to music for 14 months on a not very good stereo, which I managed to make worse because that's me, and two various sets of Bluetooth earbuds. I haven't had a genuinely physical experience with music for a long, long time. Now, the other guys in my band are real musicians, and I think they've had shows and recording sessions, and I think they've felt a bit more of that wave than I have. I don't think any of us have really been immersed in that way that, you know, we got into the game. Melvin Gibbs, the other bass player in the band, or the primary bass player in the band right now, he said something recently, I think, on Twitter about, you know, wanting to become a bass player because of how that sound felt and how it worked in a room, how precisely the wave we're talking about. Like, he didn't pick an instrument that he could noodle around on, and it just happened to be a bass. It was the sound of the bass in physical space that attracted him to the instrument, and that's something that I've been divorced from for this entire time. So I think it's like Alex is saying, I think I'm probably going to feel really, really emotional, not just to be playing music, but to be around other people playing it. And my immediate answer to your question is, like, I don't care what form it takes. I will be so unbelievably open-minded about any form of live music. Yeah. Anything that anybody wants to do, immediately, I love it. It's the best show I've ever seen.
Right. So they should get their reviews from you very early on.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think of myself as a thumbs up or a stars kind of reviewer, but yes.
No. I don't think of you that way either. But I'm just saying your hunger and your appetite will be so great. You know, when I spoke to you about the work of mourning, I was quoting an English psychoanalyst I deeply admire called Adam Phillips, and Adam has said something really important that I think works beautifully in the context we're speaking about. He said, you can't tickle yourself.
Mm-hmm.
We need others, and this notion that we will be proximate again will change the ways in which we interact with people, and hopefully the scar and trauma of the pandemic might make us realize that we can behave differently in the company of others.
That's a great point. I think I realize I've omitted something from last weekend, or maybe the weekend before. There was a bit in the paper about it because we live right next to Tompkins Square Park, and it was a concert which ended up being much, much bigger than it was supposed to be. And we ended up seeing it, not intentionally. We were just there to just be outside. And it was sort of the first day outside, I'm going to call it that. So there was a lot of emotion. There was a man flashing these women. It was mayhem. But anyway, so these bands were playing. It was two hardcore bands from like my youth, Madball and Murphy's Law. Is that right? Yeah. Maybe I'm getting that wrong. And then there was a white reggae band that played first. And anyway, it was all very strange. But what happened there is that the music, I, so sort of thought everyone sounded great, but I noticed that, you know, it's outside, so we don't have that reverberation and resonance and wave sort of situation quite so much, because it's, you know, it dissipates in the air. But the sociality, the act of being around other people in that moment took precedence over the music happening. So I was thinking like, oh, I guess this is the first concert I'm seeing. But it was also the first crowd I was in. And the crowd at that point was so much more overwhelming. And that's an interesting word, because when Heidi and I got home, as much as we had loved being out, I was experiencing this very fractured sense of time, because I've been here my whole life. When I went over to Avenue A and walked up 9th to get something, I started having like actual glitching. Like it seemed like 1981. It seemed like 1991. It seemed like 2001. Like I was seeing people in the street, and that was so strange that it was completely scrambling my sort of data centers in my head. And I ended up feeling exhausted by being around so many people. It initially felt really great. It felt like a reconnection that I needed, just seeing people do the mundane things they do, and dancing and being weird or whatever they do. But when we got home, I had a real sense of relief. Like there seems to be some emotional math going on. Like when I'm in a small room of, or a large room actually, of 25 people all meditating, like that felt great. But being in a big crowd again didn't feel 100% like something I was ready for. Maybe it's not something I've ever liked. You know, it's going to be hard to get false positives and, you know, how do we know what we like because of or irrelevant to the pandemic? I don't know that I said that particularly well, but, you know, in the aftermath of a huge event, it's easy to tie everything to that event. And there are going to be some things we experience that I don't think are necessarily tied to the events of the last 14, 15 months.
No, it will be interesting, you know, in closing to think what will happen? What will the next chapter be? And you were talking about meetings. Will big companies say, well, you know, we don't really need to meet in person. Let's just meet, not for the 15-minute Zoom call that you were talking about, but even extended meetings. Why really meet in person? And I think there lies a danger.
A danger of?
If you're not able to read facial expressions really well, if you're not really able to walk out of the meeting and have other moments that are perhaps not immediately relevant to the meeting, but become relevant because they're part of the story, I think there's a danger. Or if people say, well, you know, maybe school worked well on Zoom. Technology worked well. Why really bother?
New York City's just announced that instead of snow days, kids are going to have remote learning days next year,
right.
Which is criminal and makes me want to burn things down more than I normally want to burn them down, which is every day, all day. But I think the real danger is that how our work is going to be more exploited by this technology. I think there's some freedom to be gained. I mean, it's a moment of resistance. There's always a need for resistance, but this is a moment where as much power as can be taken back needs to be taken back. And I mean, my hopes are low insofar as I think we're at a really terrifying peak of exploitation, and disenfranchisement. And I'm really worried. I mean, you saw what happened to Bezos and all these people during the pandemic. I mean, their worth just like skyrocketed because we've, you know, created these, you know, I hate to be this obvious, but we watched it the other night. It's very much like the Matrix. We've got these workers isolated in pods. You know, they're being fed just enough to keep them alive. And if the gig economy and work for hire and remote working makes it easier for companies to control workers, which is unfortunately the case in a lot of the time, like we're heading into something even worse. But that I don't think that, because I believe in collective action and I believe that people can live a different way. And I think, you know, the math aspect of the last 14 months is, I think, what the Amazons of the world have not fully considered, which is that people now know what they need to get by. They probably knew beforehand, but a lot of people weren't thinking about what's the bare minimum. Well, now they know. And that's something you never want the worker to figure out, because then the worker knows, like, hey, I don't need X, Y, and Z. Why was I going through all of that for X, Y, and Z? We're fine with what we've got here. Why am I doing this? Because the illusion is gone. So many illusions are gone, which I think a little bit relates back to what Nico Mealy was saying. I hope that this infernal screen that we've been, you know, I can't even tell you how bad my eyesight is now. Like, we've all been suffering with these screens, but I do think we've discovered some hope in these screens, some ways of being together that are going to take some of this power back. And maybe I'm just a dumb optimist, but I think that's true.
Sasha, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. I wish we could continue. And I have to say, I had so many other questions, so many things I wanted to talk to you about, such as your passage working for Genius, which is something that I discovered only very recently. Mm. But another time, and it's been very, very good to talk to you. And I send you all my best, and I hope when time and permits us again to travel, we will meet in person. It's been a real pleasure to speak to you. Thank you for taking
I would love
time.
That, Paul.
All the
it's
best.
Been a pleasure for me. All Thank the, you.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
To support this show and DubLab's progressive programming, go to dublab.com/support.